Hey, you don't owe me. But,
what are you selling something there?
No, no.
Who's this?
I'm here because, you have a son named Sean.
Yeah?
Well, I had a little trouble with him tonight.
Like what?
Well, he threatened me. He threatened to beat me up.
Would you come in, please?
Yeah, sure.
Jimmy, turn that shit down.
I'm playing!
Turn it down, goddammit!
So, what happened?
Well, I was at this donut place on 14th Street, and I was on a date, and, well, Sean came in with all these friends of his, and they were just making a racket, and nobody could talk or anything, so I asked him to keep it down. He starts threatening me and saying that he could beat me up. He's saying that he's beat other people up, and he's saying that, well, he said that if I didn't ask him not to, that he would beat the shit out of me.
Oh, my God. So how did you get started being a comedian?
Oh, well, I started in high school.
Really?
When I was 18.
Titties.
So hard, dude.
I was right out of high school. I found out you could do open mic nights in Boston, so I started getting interested. Sorry.
Oh, you?
You
this one right here?
You had that Asian chick right in front of you. You're a loser!
There's nobody can even talk.
No.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, I really am interested that you started so young.
You are?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I was in high school.
Hey, guys!
Could you keep it down, please? Thank you. Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, there was these clubs in Boston that you could go on, and they were just like open mic nights. You could just anytime you wanted to.
How's it going?
Fine.
I'm sorry, were we bothering you guys back there?
Yeah, actually you were. That's why I asked you to be quiet, and you did, so thank you.
Oh, that's all right. I'm Sean.
Sean, got it. Thanks.
Got it? Thanks? That's your name?
No, it's Louie.
Ah, okay. Louie. Louie.
Come on.
Hey, what's up, Louie?
Why don't you go back with your friends, okay?
Nah, see, I don't really feel like it, Louie. Hey, Louie, can I ask you a question? When was the last time you got your ass kicked?
What?
Man, you heard me. When was the last time you got your ass kicked? Just curious. What? You scared? Are you scared right now?
No.
No?
No, I'm not scared of you.
Why?
Because I'm a grown man. I'm not afraid of some young kid, some high school bully.
Oh, you're not afraid of high school?
No.
So what if I just decided to kick your ass right now? What would you do then? Huh? Do you want that? I'm serious. I can hurt you really bad. Right now. You see this? It's just 2 days ago. Destroyed this guy's face, must have hit him like 40 times. Teeth were all over the place. Just left him there bleeding. Probably sent him to the hospital, I don't know. Are you ready for that? Because I'm kind of feeling like doing that to you right now. I'm going to be honest. I'm kind of leaning that way. I don't know. Maybe if you ask me nicely or something, I won't do it. But then again, I don't know. I don't know how I'll feel. You know? I don't know how it would feel. Maybe you'll ask me nicely, and I'll still beat the shit out of you. Maybe I won't. So what do you say, Louie? Huh?
Please don't. What do you want me to...
Don't what?
Don't kick my ass, okay?
I don't like how you said that.
Why? What?
Ask nice. Ask better. It was fake. Ask again. Now.
Okay. Please don't kick my ass, okay? You're very strong and young. I get it. You could kick my ass. I'm sure you could. So I'm really asking you nicely to please not kick my ass, okay?
That was hard to watch. All right, Louie. Come on, guys, let's go.
Let's leave Louie to his date. Let him have his next
one. Enjoy the kids, okay?
Louie! Alright, Louie! Go get him, Louie!
Good job!
That guy was a nightmare, huh? What?
What? Nothing.
You didn't really want me to fight that guy, did you?
No.
That guy was pretty serious.
Of course.
Hey, look, if you need to be with some guy that gets into fights with dumb young jocks, that's...
No.
I got two kids, you know, I'm not...
No, I would never. You did the right thing. I mean, of course not.
I mean, that was, you know, it was pretty humiliating.
Yeah.
Hey, look, I'm getting this weird feeling like you're looking down at me right now for what just happened.
I would never want a guy to fight. That's, of course, it's so stupid. I'd be pissed if you did. And, you know, I mean, being violent is just the dumbest thing ever. And, you know, who cares what you have to say to get the guy off your back? I totally feel that way. But,
What?
I don't know. I mean, if I'm being totally honest, that was a turnoff, seeing that.
Jesus Christ.
I'm sorry, I can't help it. I don't know. It's like a primitive thing or something. I mean, you see this guy just totally debase himself, and it's like, just to be safe, it's a turnoff.
That's seriously a real bummer. You know, I gotta criticize you a little bit for that. Because that's why there's wars and stuff, you know? Women like you that choose stupid strong people over the weak and the gentle.
Listen, look. Okay, I'm a grown woman. And my mind is telling me that you are a great guy. But my chemistry is telling me that you're a loser. I mean, I'm surprised, you know, by my own reaction, but, you know, I have no defense. I mean, I'm completely surprised by my own feelings about it.
I think you said enough things.
I'm sorry.
Okay? So let's maybe put you in a cab now.
Did you leave a tip or something?
I got it. Okay?
Yeah. It's a great donut, though.
Yeah, thank you.
Madame, because you're a woman and I'm a man and you're strong and mighty.
What happened?
Well, I was at this donut place on 14th Street and I was on a date. And, Sean came in with all these friends of his and they were just making a racket and nobody could talk or anything. So I asked him to keep it down. He starts threatening me and saying that he could beat me up. He's saying that he's beat other people up, and he's saying that, well, he said that if I didn't ask him not to, that he would beat the shit out of me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, look, nothing happened to me. I'm okay, but it was scary. You know, I'm not a fighting guy. I'm 42. I got children. I'm not going to get in a fight with somebody. But, look, he threatened me, and that's illegal.
Sean, get down here. Sean!
What?
Get down here!
What?
Are you bothering this guy?
What the hell?
What did you do?
What the hell are you doing
what
here?
What did you say?
Listen, I don't know what this guy told you.
You goddamn...
Shit, Dad, I don't know what I told you!
I don't know what
you
told me. Tell him you're sorry, goddammit!
Stop hitting him! How do you think he turned out like this?
What are you talking about? He's no good!
Oh, don't say that! He's your kid! He probably could have been a good kid. He's obviously smart. But you teach him to just hit people. What was he gonna be but a stupid bully? I mean, you never gave him a chance.
Hey, screw you! Who the hell are you?
What?
Get the hell out of my house, you faggot!
What are you talking
Tell me how to raise my kid! Go back to New York, you bomb-a-loving faggot!
Jesus.
Who needs you?
Hey. Hey, buddy, listen.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I don't know what to do. I mean, I got three kids in there, and, you know, he's 18 now, you know. I don't know what to do.
Listen, I don't know what you're dealing with, you know. I mean, I got two kids, but they're girls, and the oldest one's 8, so I don't know. I mean, I guess I would go with maybe not hitting them. That doesn't seem like such a great idea.
Well, that's what I know. My dad hit me and his dad him.
And how's that going?
Yeah.
Self-assertion does not mean belligerence or inappropriate aggressiveness. It does not mean pushing to the front of the line or knocking other people over. It does not mean upholding my own rights while being blind or indifferent to everyone else's. It simply means the willingness to stand up for myself, to be who I am openly, to treat myself with respect in all human encounters. To practice self-assertiveness is to live authentically. To speak and act from my innermost convictions and feelings, as a way of life, as a rule, allowing for the obvious fact that there may be particular circumstances in which I may justifiably choose not to do so. While appropriate self-expression varies with the context, in every situation there is a choice between being authentic or inauthentic, real or unreal. If we do not want to face this, of course, we will deny that we have such a choice. We will assert that we are helpless, but the choice is always there.
Hey, Wes, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Brett.
My pleasure. We're on to pillar number 4, the practice of self-assertiveness.
Indeed. Yeah, this is another short chapter in his book, and there's an audiobook to this as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He has quite a bit of audio content, by the way. I think on his site, he's got a bookstore there that's got all kinds of audios. And then there was an internet marketing guy that got together with him and did a bunch of the audio content as well. But it all revolves around the same topics, you know, these self-esteem issues, the need for self-esteem that relates to so many different aspects of our consciousness and our behaviors, right?
Yes, and there's a very good, you can find a lot of his presentations on YouTube as well. There's a video that I wanted to include in our third show, which will be the past for most people, but at this point is still the future for me because I haven't even started editing it yet.
Mm-hmm.
The third installment, the practice of self-responsibility or living responsibly, it's called Self-Esteem and Libertarianism.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting thing because I've been doing this series simultaneously with Thaddeus Russell.
Yeah.
He is, some might say he's very hostile towards the statist, big government, progressive left, the scientific management of society, as it's been called.
Has lots of critiques of that perspective, huh?
Yeah. And as we're doing this simultaneously, it's actually helping me sympathize a little bit more with that point of view, because it seems to, a lot of people taking on that belief system at various levels of life or power or influence, it seems to relate to some deficits in what we're talking about here.
Mm, yeah. You know? So it's almost as if the overall view of the progressive or liberal mindset is that humans are weak and need to be taken care of by some sort of authority, or monitored or watched by some authority, you know, just dealt with in some way to make up for their inherent deficits in a sense. Like, we don't really believe in ourselves fully. So we need to have this omnipresent state taking care of things.
Yeah, and just point of clarification, because I know when I say the left, the liberals, the progressives, I sound like Sean Hannity, but to me, the entire political spectrum is the left. In that,
for sure,
conservatives are people who talk like libertarians when they're out of power, and behave exactly like progressives when they're in power, and talk exactly like progressives when they're in power. They just change the language a little bit. So I see the entire thing is corrupted by this big government statist ideology. And, you know, that follows what you were just saying, that I'm not targeting half of that spectrum.
Yeah, by no means is this philosophical perspective presented by Brandon aligned with the right, you know, and you could see the right as maybe lacking a degree of trust in humans to do what is helpful for themselves and others.
Mm-hmm.
So on one side, maybe see weakness, other side, distrust. But I think they're both part and parcel of the same psychological package, aren't they? That we can't be fully independent human beings as adults. We can't have our own property, you know, and use it as we see fit. You know, we have to have this apparatus of control to tell us what to do and when to do it, and punish us when we don't do it.
Right. You know? Yeah, absolutely.
And the whole legal framework, laws, are that mechanism that people use to enforce their fears, you know, the things that they don't want to see people do, or they do want to see people do. Like it's just set up to deny the belief in self, it seems like.
Prejudices enforced through law or reinforced through law.
Yeah, a lot of people see, you know, the human rights movement rather than individual rights movement, actually, as a way to have government make up for all the injustices that the private sector, that people in general have, the prejudices that they have, discrimination and all that. But in fact, some of the worst sort of injustices have been perpetrated by those in government, using law to enforce all kinds of bigotry.
Yeah, the other thing too is people could say that it's forwarding the problems that we're talking about, the human rights movement, or certain groups, you know, corralling people as a group and then telling them what they want their rights to be.
Mm-hmm.
In no way moving forward, and in no way acknowledging, of course, the smallest and most oppressed minority in American history, the individual.
Yeah, yeah, and Brandon spends a bit of time in the chapter pointing out that self-assertiveness ought not be confused with rebelliousness, you know, and I think there's a lot of rebellion going on in the land called politics. Like, it's trying to get your way at the expense of other people, because you got to get, well, the getting's good, you know, get your special interest group in there to fight the good fight so that you can get your way. And so there's a lot of rebellion against other people's views, and it's just not that authentic realm of, you know, Brandon has a useful way of summing it up, saying yes when we want to say yes and no when we want to say no. That is the practice of self-assertiveness.
Yeah. And yeah, I think that's really interesting, because that plays out in other ways as well. And as we said previously in this series, and probably I've said in many other places, the political arena is in many ways a magnification of some of the attributes, or some of the real, the biggest, I don't want to say our worst qualities, but some of the biggest struggles we have as individuals get kind of magnified and normalized in that arena, you know? Mm-hmm. It's all resentment and fear and doubt and aggressiveness. And yeah, that what he calls a mindless rebelliousness, which is that's actually a good place for us to start today.
Uh-huh.
With the fact that self-assertiveness, I've heard described as a negative quality, you know, maybe even described as selfishness. Uh-huh. And of course, described as disobedience. Right. So we're never given any concept of what Brandon calls an intelligent selfishness, you know, one that is mindful and respectful of self. We're just told that it's selfishness, and all of these qualities that could be described as selfishness are basically universally bad. So I think mindless rebelliousness, which we mentioned already, is obviously a trait of young adults, teenagers, maybe even a little bit younger than that, who have had no practice in what healthy, tactful self-assertiveness looks like, because it's discouraged in basically every environment we're in, you know, for some of us, for our entire lives.
Yeah.
But certainly when we're young.
We're taught the ethics of sacrifice as a virtue. So we sacrifice our self-interest for the sake of others or the collective. And I guess people have this notion that self-assertiveness means pushing yourself to the front of the line, you know, that kind of assertive nature.
Yeah.
But that obviously is a conflicted state of consciousness where you're rebelling against other people's rules or mores, strictures, those kinds of things. And that's not the genuine self-assertiveness that Brandon is talking about. I think he uses a really great example that he's used throughout his life with seminars and stuff that he's given about the right to exist for your own sake. You know, because all of these political systems and a lot of the social systems, the things that practice power over strategies with other people that don't look for win-win strategies, but rather win-lose, and that punish people if they don't do what they're told. I mean, those all are conveying that we don't have a right to exist for our own sake. There's not a belief in the self in that way. You know, we're supposed to exist for the sake of the family, or for the sake of getting good grades, you know, for the sake of getting a good job, for the sake of paying our taxes, being a good citizen, being law abiding, you know, we're not existing for our own sake because we have all these extrinsic motivators that take us away from our authentic self. So, like, he asked people in the audience to, if there's anyone that wants to come up to the stage and say plainly that I have a right to exist, he doesn't add for my own sake, but just I have a right to exist, just say that plainly and see if it's believable. See if the people in the audience believe that what you're saying is really integrated within you. Mm-hmm. And invariably, it comes out in all kinds of different ways that are not so authentic. People notice that there's a lack of conviction about it in an authentic way, you know? And people say, well, I think maybe they're just afraid of speaking in public, right? Which is a common thing as well, like being judged by an audience. That is like one of the number one fears done in surveys, you know?
Yeah.
But he says, well, we can test that one just by saying, okay, now say 2 and 2 make 4. And that's usually done with a great degree of authenticity. People buy that one. 2 and 2 make 4.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So to have the ease by which to say, I have a right to exist in the same way that that 2 and 2 make 4,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's kind of what we're aiming for here, because we can't be fully autonomous. We can't meet our need for autonomy when we're sort of in this obedient mindset to all kinds of things external to ourselves. And then we end up saying yes when we want to say no, and no when we want to say yes, perhaps.
Yeah. So what you just said, before we go any further, I just want to put a clear definition based on, you know, paraphrasing what he says in the book to what he describes as the practice of self-assertiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Honoring the wants, needs, and values, and finding appropriate forms of expression for them. And then one of the quotes that I grabbed, to practice self-assertiveness is to live authentically, to speak and act from my innermost convictions and feelings as a way of life, as a rule. So what you were speaking to is very much, you know, the opposite of that, kind of this surrender, a word that comes up a lot, to timidity, to a desire to belong, to placate other people, to please other people, and for some of us, even to get what we want out of people or manipulate them. And, you know, I certainly know the feeling of what he calls inflicting wounds on ourselves. When, you know, I feel like there's a lot of times in my life where I've walked away from a specific situation or a specific conversation or even an entire relationship with that, the wound I inflicted on myself, because I walk away saying, if I had just done this, or if I had just said this, or relating to the other pillars as well, if I had just recognized this deficit in myself and fixed it, you know, so that failure of self-assertiveness can stay with us. But the other problem is that if we're not practicing this, we can't really get genuine feedback on who we really are, which can be very valuable, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. To see that's a degree of visibility that's really important, because if we don't assert our needs, our wants, our convictions, then we don't clarify to other people who we are, what matters to us, what's the meaning behind our statements.
Yeah.
And there's oftentimes a fear that other people are going to judge us harshly, disapprove of us, just like perhaps in childhood when we asserted ourselves independently, we were judged harshly. You know, and I think that moralistic judgment really short circuits this authentic self-assertiveness that is everyone's birthright, because by virtue of existing, you need to seek out things that are going to provide for yourself and to be helpful for yourself, to yourself, in many ways.
You've got a family of birds.
A family of birdies. Yeah, they showed up here. The cat's liking them, although there's a window barrier.
Well, you know, luck. I'm glad they're there, because if they were outside my window, they would look a lot like frozen food.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. No cockatoos, though, have you know. We're not in Sydney, so no cockatoos.
Oh, okay. So that's probably better, right?
That's the most annoying bird on the planet, by the way, Brett.
I believe you.
Oh, especially like a flock of about 100 of them. You can't even hear yourself think. There's no way. You can barely even have a conversation.
All right. So let's see. I felt like there was one more. There was this really, before we move on too far from this idea of getting no practice as youngsters with a healthy and mindful practice of self-assertiveness, I've had this, it's kind of been a recurring theme on our after shows or any other content that I produce that is either more for comedic value or not for widespread consumption, but I want to share this with you, right? Because you could probably talk me into a more constructive way of thinking about this. I often sum it up as my customer service rant. And I presented this idea on podcast before that the experiences that we go through either in childhood generally or specifically in school translate to often a kind of surrendering consumer behavior. Where people are overly tolerant of bad service or low quality products. And as far as the mindless rebelliousness piece, from my experience working in customer service and observing it, there wasn't much in between. There was either people who, and I'm exaggerating a little, they would walk up to the counter when I worked in a convenience store with a Coke. And I could say, that'll be $75. And they would pay it and walk away quietly. And then the other extreme, somebody who would really get in your face, right? And make demands and be very rude. And these were all, you know, when a potential for a problem existed. But there wasn't much in the middle of people who said, okay, well, I recognize that there seems to be, you know, I'm unhappy. And this is what I'd like done. You don't see a lot of that. You either see people who will put up with things they shouldn't. I mean, I hope I'm not being too black and white here. This is just my observation. Or people who jump at any opportunity to use the fact that, hey, you're in a customer service job and I'm always right because I'm the customer. So I'm going to bully you a little bit, right?
Yeah, I'm going to test your limits of patience.
So we don't see anything. We see a complete lack of self-assertiveness where there should be some, or what we maybe formulated in our young schoolboy and schoolgirl minds is what self-assertiveness is, which is belligerence and bullying and selfishness and over-aggressiveness. So those were. You know, my experiences reflecting on a few years in customer service as a young man, and my observations as an adult, kind of recognizing some of the adverse consequences of schooling as a consumer and a customer, where people, a couple of times I encountered customer service people who were kind of stunned that I objected to some part of the customer service process, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, people tend to have that sort of corporate persona that they put on when they deal with humans and customer service. And I remember talking to a psychologist, Guy Winch, on Healthy Mind, Fit Body. We interviewed him. He's got a book called The Squeaky Wheel, How to Complain the Right Way to Get Kind of What You Want.
Mm-hmm.
It has what he calls a complaint sandwich, where you deliver the message, your critique, your criticism, your complaint in a way that is most likely to get heard and acted upon by the person. And typically he says people complain about things to a dozen different people, none of whom can actually fix the problem that they're complaining about.
Mm-hmm.
So that speaks to self-assertiveness too, like to home in on the particular person that can help you with the problem, rather than just this outburst of complaints that never really get us anywhere. But of course, the ranting, you know, there's no end to ranting in the libertarian world because of all the problems that we see, right? But at the end of the day, do we actually get our needs satisfied? I guess the need to really express what's alive in us in the rant form is getting met. But a lot of that process entails just a sense of futility or hopelessness and helplessness about it. And of course, it's important to really connect with those needs or those feelings in the process of doing that despair work about how things are just not how they can be in relation to, you know, respecting others. So I think there's a lot of surrender to fear in the realm of self-assertiveness, like not going to the particular person or the system that is causing the problem, but rather voicing one's concerns and complaints in all kinds of ways that don't actually help us.
Yeah, absolutely. When you mentioned the libertarian, like, so critical attention has to go in so many different directions, right?
Yeah.
I was going to call it social criticism, but let's call it world criticism through a libertarian lens. It reminds me of something that he says in the book that I think is really important, especially for people who are newer to these ideas, which is a time in our development that's usually tinged with much more anger.
Hmm.
That, you know, self-assertiveness is not just about what you're against, but about a healthy, responsible, and tactful way of expressing what you are for, you know? And this, I think this speaks to very important question. What kind of conditional relationships do I have? You know, what kind of relationships are being held together by the fact that I restrain myself from saying certain things, negative or positive, right? But I've been told, especially in years past, when I was trying to share some of my ideas with other people, the assessment of me was, well, you're just against everything, right? You don't like the 4th of July. You don't like the Catholic Church. You don't like George Bush. So what are you for? Right. And that's actually, I think, a pretty authentic assessment of what my affect and presentation was at that time, because everything was bullshit, you know, and I wanted to tell you about it.
Yeah.
So being able to still have that critical eye, but not so critical tongue and mouth. Right. Like Ian is a good example. Right. Ian always talks about liberty on Free Talk Live, not in terms of the state this, the state that, politicians this, politicians that. Not that we're all not susceptible to that at times, you know, even you and I probably in this show. But liberty is this. Freedom is this. Self-sufficiency is this. And even in the recognition of all these problems, the discussion has more of a positive tone.
Yeah. Yeah, Brennan has a section here. While healthy self-assertiveness requires the ability to say no, it is ultimately tested not by what we are against, but what we are for.
Indeed.
A life that consists only of a string of negations is a waste and a tragedy. Self-assertiveness asks that we not only oppose what we deplore, but that we live and express our values. In this respect, it is intimately tied to the issue of integrity. Yeah.
Think about what it does to a person's own mind, too. If everything is framed in what they don't like, you know, and everything is thought about what in terms of what the problems are, that's a lot of negativity to have dancing in one's head.
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely. It can really trip up one's path to self-actualization. He says here, one of the great self-delusions is to think of oneself as a, quote, valuer or a, quote, idealist while not pursuing one's values in reality. To dream one's life away is not self-assertion. To be able to say at the end, while my life was happening, I was there, I lived it, is. Yeah. And of course, you know, this comes right from childhood, right? What we're taught about the nature of self-assertiveness, like you say, it can be related in a pejorative way to selfishness. You know, that we're not supposed to be fully ourselves, we're not supposed to assert our wants. Especially it comes up in relation to others, you know, when we're a toddler and we're wanting to play with a toy and now we've got to share with another person. Like there's these scarcity of toys, and then there's this distrust in the child to actually have win-win interactions with other kids, and they're treated harshly and disapproved of and punished even. And so they learn that the self is this kind of conflicted entity where you have to smuggle in some self-interest, but when you're in with others, you need to sacrifice too. You know, like he says, when we were young, many of us received signals conveying that what we thought and felt or wanted was not important. We were taught, in effect, quote, what you want isn't important. What's important is what others want, unquote. Perhaps we were intimidated by accusations of, quote, selfishness when we attempted to stand up for ourselves. It often takes courage to honor what we want and to fight for it. For many people, self-surrender and self-sacrifice are far easier. They do not require integrity and responsibility that intelligent selfishness requires.
Absolutely. And I think that all of this programming when we're young leads to, speaks to what you said, just this terribly underdeveloped sense of identity. Remember MySpace?
Oh, yeah. Rupert Murdoch is in charge of that, isn't he?
I believe that. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah.
I was with a group of friends last night, and we were talking about this new trend that apparently is gaining acceptance out there. Oh, here's my libertarian world criticism hat going on.
Okay.
People have started to play music through their cell phones or their portable devices, not through headphones into their own private ears, but publicly through the speakers on that device. So you will encounter, and the fact that I saw this both in Connecticut and in New Hampshire is what kind of alerted me to the reality that this is something that's catching on. And we were talking about this last night because a friend of mine, he works at Walmart, and he's like a night manager. And he says, everyone's doing this. And I have to tell them that, you know, that's not, your own personal, this is what I like. And I said, you know what? It's like MySpace for real life. It's like MySpace becoming reality. Because if you remember what the trend was years ago, it was for self-branding. And you would go to somebody's MySpace page and an image would come up. And then like the pages loaded very slowly because they could just have a ton of content on them, things would start popping up. Right. So you'd get a background, and then it's like, here's the movies I like. Here's the bands I like. And then a song would start playing, and then a video would come up, and then you were bombarded with information about how a person defined themselves. And I probably still have a MySpace page that I haven't been on in 6 years. So people could search for me and maybe you find the same thing. I don't remember mine being too much different, but people were attaching their identity to these externalities, right?
Yeah.
And it speaks to, you know, when people don't understand self-assertiveness, and why would they? Brandon talks about people who live as spectators rather than actors or participants in their own lives. It speaks to exactly what you were talking about before. People who stand and move, and his quote was, as if they have no right to the space they occupy. But living as a spectator instead of as an actor, I think, is exactly what we're speaking about. Who are you? I'm a Limp Bizkit fan. God, why did I think of Limp Bizkit? Gross. But my identity is something outside of me. My identity is the things that I consume. I only say this because for probably a good portion of my life, I lived this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's always a voice inside us, but often it's uncomfortable and it doesn't seem to always say things that make sense. So I like to make my identity about things outside of myself.
Yeah, like my interests, a list of interests kind of is a way to gain a foothold about one's identity. I like this, I like that. And those are all, you know, genuine expressions of what, you know, is positive and pleasurable about the external world, right?
Mm. It scales up beautifully to a thing called the state as well.
Yeah, I like the Democrats' agenda. I like the Republican agenda. I like the independents or the Green Party agenda. You know, those kinds of things.
Oh, but that's interesting, though, that you say I like, because that actually relates to what we were talking about before, you know, having this negative lens, living a life of negation.
Mm-hmm.
Really, I mean, I can guarantee, I will bet people that if a politician is criticized for anything that their side does, the next words out of their mouth are what can be summed up as the to Corkray ad hominem attack, right? Where they say, yeah, but your side sucks worse, essentially. And in that arena anyway, in that very specific arena, nobody has anything good to say about themselves or their side or their political identity. It's always like, yeah, but have you seen the other guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm willing to put up with all these drawbacks because the other guys are, you know, worse, way worse.
So that's worse than MySpace. That's forming an identity based on what I don't like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It really is. You know, so what, you know, he's got these four things of what self-esteem or self-assertiveness is or what self-assertion is not. And the fourth one, he said it entails a willingness to confront rather than to evade the challenges of life and to strive for mastery. When we expand the boundaries of our ability to cope, we expand self-efficacy and self-respect. When we commit ourselves to new areas of learning, when we take on tasks that stretch us, we raise personal power. We thrust ourselves further into the universe. We assert our existence. When we are attempting to understand something and we hit a wall, it is an act of self-assertiveness to persevere. When we undertake to acquire new skills, absorb new knowledge, extend the reach of our mind across unfamiliar spaces, when we commit ourselves to moving to a higher level of competence, we are practicing self-assertiveness. Yeah, so we're not just tearing down other people's arguments, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When we learn how to be in an intimate relationship without abandoning our sense of self, when we learn how to be kind without being self-sacrificing, when we learn how to cooperate with others without betraying our standards and convictions, we are practicing self-assertiveness.
And I translated everything you just said into a bulleted list on my outline, which I will put in the show notes, called What Does Self-Assertiveness Look Like?
Yeah.
Which I think is very important, that there are some actual identifiable properties of healthy self-assertive behavior.
Mm-hmm. So it kind of speaks to why we would be fearful of these things, you know, because it gets back to the childhood dynamic as well. Like, we don't tend to fear these things as children. But as adults, I mean, we live in a world of lots of nice dead people, as Marshall Rosenberg says. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are in touch with their needs don't make very good slaves. Unfortunately, there's a lot of disconnection from needs in this culture, you know?
Yeah, and still a lot of encouragement of that, right? And based on what we said at the beginning of the conversation, you know, how dare you, child? Don't you understand that you're a part of a family or a classroom or, you know, a society, a community? There's lots of euphemisms for what you're really sacrificing to, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, it reminds me, like, I don't regret shitting on MySpace because I think it was just an unbearable web experience looking back at it. But yes. I do want to say too that there are tremendous benefits when it comes to identity and self-assertiveness in today. You know, the benefits of being nonconformist, non-self-sacrificial in idea or in practice, we have avenues and channels that did not exist through all of history. And things like MySpace would be one of them, because there's this question that I've asked myself several times when studying history, right? And you looked at some of the repression that existed, whether we're talking about Puritan New England or communist Russia or North Korea, like we talked about before. But you could take this back to, you know, times in Europe where nobody strayed, or most people didn't stray more than 10 miles away from where they were born. And they were born with a role in a farming village or a small community, and they were never going to be anything else.
It didn't allow for much individuation, did it?
Right. So the question is, you know, how many great minds and how many great ideas were just suppressed throughout history and faded into nothing simply because they had nowhere to go?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And in the systems of power over, the domination systems that really discouraged self-assertiveness and didn't enable people to really make the most of their lives, their individual lives. They surrendered to the fear of disapproval, of standing out among others, you know, because then they could get hated upon, you know, and just disowned in a sense in the community because they are not going with the flow. And I think that's probably a huge aspect of why we have all this momentum of collectivism in our culture. There is this fear of standing alone, of fully individuating. And there's this notion that, you know, in America, there's an overemphasis on individualism, right? I've heard that. People say that, you know.
Yep.
We are a very individualistic nation. That's why there's all the, you know, the gangs and the guns and the killing, the violence and all that. But this is the result of that rebellious self-assertiveness from all of the strictures and rules that are imposed on people early on. And there's the other way to go is just to conform and comply. So yeah, we've got this mixture of these two really tragic ways of dealing with the power over systems. And Brandon has an interesting set of statements here under this fear of self-assertiveness. He says, individuation raises the specter of isolation to those who have not achieved it and do not understand that far from being the enemy of community, it is its necessary precondition. A healthy society is a union of self-respecting individuals. It is not a coral bush.
Right.
Yeah. A well-realized man or woman is one who has moved successfully along two lines of development that serve and complement each other, the track of individuation and the track of relationship. Autonomy on the one hand, the capacity for intimacy and human connectedness on the other. Persons with an underdeveloped sense of identity often tell themselves, if I express myself, I may evoke disapproval. If I love and affirm myself, I may evoke resentment. If I am too happy with myself, I may evoke jealousy. If I stand out, I may be compelled to stand alone. They remain frozen in the face of such possibilities and pay a terrible price in loss of self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. And contrary to that, I, while reading the book, pulled out what turned out to be a list of appropriate C words, we could call it. Hmm. Commitment to my right to exist, as far as the opposite of what you just described. Conviction that my ideas and my wants are important. The conclusion, this relates to the previous pillar, that no one is coming, that we're responsible for our own existences. And, you know, all of those relate to courage, I think.
Mm-hmm.
To practice self-assertiveness.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it can be really subtle things too. Like he gives an example here of a man sitting in the darkness of a movie theater, deeply inspired by the drama unfolding before him. The story touches him so deeply that tears come to his eyes. He knows that in a week or so, he will want to come back and see this film again. In the lobby, he spots a friend who was at the same screening, and they greet each other. He searches his friend's face for clues to his feelings about the movie, but the face is blank. The friend inquires, "How'd you like the picture?" The young man feels an instant stab of fear. He does not want to appear uncool. He does not want to say the truth. "I loved it. It touched me very deeply." So instead he shrugs indifferently and says, "Not bad." He does not know that he has just slapped his own face. Or rather, he does not know it consciously. His diminished self-esteem knows it.
Man, that is like the story of my young life.
Wow. And so many people's young lives. Think, like, how many times have we held within
absolutely
what our deepest convictions or our profound moving moments were for the sake of fitting in or appearing cool, you know?
You know, it's so funny. Before the show, I mean, it's just like I remember that so many times, and I think I really, really started to become conscious of it maybe like in middle school. Right? Where suddenly the social environment is so much, I mean, it's different for everybody, but I went to like, I lived in a town that had less than 1,000 people in it. So we all went to elementary school there. You know, there was 300 kids in the, you know, 200 kids in the whole school.
It's like
school.
My school. Yeah. Middle of nowhere, Idaho.
Then middle school, five towns come together. You know, so suddenly it's like this huge crowd, and there's this heightened like awareness of fitting in and cliques.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were some, like, I remember elementary school being kind of cliquey, but it was kind of like, hey, you're all just here together. This is elementary school. You know, there's the swings. You know, it's time for recess. And like everybody, not that it was friction free, but it wasn't super, super cliquey. The middle school and high school, it was like very, I remember having to like this panic when I realized I didn't have the right wardrobe, you know? And I was like, I can't go back to school without J. Crew clothes. I was like 13, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. But the last time, the reason why I said this is so funny is like before we started the show today, I was talking to you about my resurgent interest in NWA, a rap group that I liked when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when I was a junior or a senior, there was this big rap, what's it called? Beef. Yeah, a beef when two guys get along, right? So,
or I've got a beef with you.
So when I was a junior, this album came out called The Chronic by Dr. Dre, right? Dr. Dre is all like, I'm the best and Eazy-E is my enemy and he sucks. And then Eazy-E came out with an album like six, and we're like, yeah, Dr. Dre, Eazy-E's a bitch. Uh-huh. And then like 6 months later, and I was at a clique of like, I had like this clique of like maybe seven or eight like pot smoking friends, and we'd just ride around in the car getting baked and listening to gangster rap. So 6 months later, Eazy-E comes out with his album and he's shitting on Dr. Dre. And suddenly there was like, well, what's the right side of this issue to come down on? Right? Because there's like skin in the game socially. Yeah. For this, that was the last time I really, really remember that kind of awareness. Maybe I'd have to like pry into college memories more to find it. And I'm sure it was there to some extent. But like middle school and high school was really probably the most heightened my awareness of this ever was. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do you remember having that internal voice in the back of your mind, like, just observing the spectacle of what's going on, you know, the way the identity is being tied to these various external things and wanting to kind of like make more meaning of what your life was? Because I think a lot of people have that voice and it just gets kind of muffled, right?
Yeah, that kind of authentic voice that's like, wow, man, mm-hmm. really? Mm-hmm. This is what you're focusing your attention on?
Yeah, it may come through with just like the fear, the stab of fear that like this guy had. About, oh no, now he's in a situation where, you know, his authenticity is on the line. You know, how do I state what really moved me and still keep a connection there? Because the desire is to keep the connection. And whenever we say something that's contrary to what another person believes or what they like, then we stand out in contrast. And that can be a bit unnerving, uncomfortable, upsetting, and scary, you know, in many ways, because we want to stay connected. I think that's one of the big deals about being a human, is we're these social animals, but we're also independent creatures and we think for ourselves. No one can think our thoughts. We're not here to live up to other people's expectations. Nope. That's what Brandon says.
Do you want to know though? This is interesting, slightly uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. When a inkling of this feeling, these questions, these worries, if I express myself, you know, if I stand out, those kinds of things, when that crept back just a little bit, not to the same extent that it was in middle school and high school, was when I became a, we'll call it, liberty-minded content creator.
Mm-hmm. Right? That's really stepping out there, isn't it?
Yeah, if I put something on the internet and I'm wrong, I'm ruined.
I'm exposed, right?
Exactly. Or if I'm inconsistent, right? Or if I can't live entirely in integrity with everything I've expressed ever publicly. Well, the truth is that I feel like I've tried to do my best in all those areas, but like it's okay that there have been, mistakes here and there. But I remember when I was new to it, it was kind of scary.
Yeah. We do have this need for integrity, right? To live up to our own expectations. And I think expectations themselves can get us into trouble because it's like now we've set the standard that if we don't reach it, somehow we're less than, you know? And I think the importance of self-esteem is knowing that you are a person worthy of happiness, regardless of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And your mind is capable of thinking and judging the facts of reality, objective reality, you know? Each mind has this capacity as a reasoning mind to do that. So that kind of gets us back on this track of thinking that whatever we do and whatever mistakes we make are inconsequential to our basic sense of worthiness, our acceptance of self that enables us to do better things for ourselves as we go through this thing called life, you know?
And those mistakes contain information.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Brandon gives an example, his personal example of when he was with Ayn Rand for a number of years, you know, and they had this profound relationship in many ways. And he got a lot of visibility from that. But he says, you know, only gradually did I realize that she did not tolerate disagreement well, not among intimates. Mm-hmm. She did not require full agreement among acquaintances, but with anyone who wanted to be truly close, enormous enthusiasm was expected for every deed and utterance. Yeah. I did not notice the steps by which I learned to censor negative reactions to some of her behavior. When, for example, I found her self-congratulatory remarks excessive or her lack of empathy disquieting or her pontificating unworthy of her, I did not give her the kind of corrective feedback everyone needs from time to time. In its absence, we can become too insulated from reality, as she did.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
To be someone who was so logical and so capable.
Kind of surrendering, susceptible to surrendering to fear still.
If that's what it was, surrendering to this fear of being close with someone who doesn't see eye to eye with you on everything in the moment.
Yeah, of losing the connection once again. Like he says in later years, after the break, I often reflected on why I did not speak up more often. I, who was, at least relatively, freer than with her than anyone else in our circle. They called that inner circle the collective, ironically enough. The simple truth was I valued her self-esteem too much to place it in jeopardy. Interesting. And I had, in effect, become addicted to it. It seems to me, in retrospect, that she had a genius for inspiring just such addictions by the subtlety, artistry, and astonishing insightfulness with which she could make people feel better understood and appreciated than they ever had felt before. I do not deny personal responsibility. No one can be seduced without consent. In exchange for the intoxicating gratification of being treated as a demigod by the person I valued above all others and whose good opinion I treasured above all others, I leashed my self-assertiveness in ways that over time were damaging to my self-regard. In the end, I learned an invaluable lesson. I learned that surrenders of this kind do not work. They merely postpone confrontations that are inevitable and necessary. I learned that the temptation to self-betrayal can sometimes be worse with those with whom we care the most. I learned that no amount of admiration for another human being can justify sacrificing one's judgment. Yeah, valuable lessons.
Connects to what I was saying about the inflicting wounds on ourselves, right? And the situations or experiences we walk away from with that feeling that he's describing, you know, if I had done this, if I had known this, if I had really acted this way instead of being a spectator in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the real challenge for us as independent thinkers, anyone who wants to think independently and go against the grain in this culture, is okay, so we can make peace with being individuated and essentially isolated and alone in many respects culturally, yet it's the challenge of connecting with others, of maintaining connections, creating connections, getting those connection needs met within us. Those are psychological needs that are really important for nurturing, for empathy, for love, for intimacy, for inclusion, you know, for belonging. All those kinds of connection needs are vital for our psychology. So that's the real challenge for the individualist, you know, in a culture like this. As Brandon says, in a culture that really respects individualism, it's going to be much easier to get those needs met because people aren't going to be on board with the notion of self-sacrifice, you know. And that's kind of the picture that Rand wanted to portray in Galt's Gulch, in Atlas Shrugged, you know, a place where no one surrenders to others or to their own notions of what living ought to be like according to all kinds of belief systems that don't accord with reality, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, don't you think that's one of the biggest challenges for us in this culture to really get our connection needs met, especially in relation to the power over domination systems that lend themselves to so much criticism? You know, we can spend our time ranting against all these things that are contrary to self-esteem, but where does that actually get us? How can we connect with others that are not doing what we like, you know, what we really want, and what's going to be most beneficial for everyone in a way that's going to, you know, going to be conciliatory and amicable, and it's going to be appreciated? You know, that's a real challenge, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think part of the beginning phases of building that bridge is recognizing that, you know, a lot of other people have their lists of priorities and values look very different. I remember, you know, I feel like I've had a lot of conversations where people gave me this gift, you know, of authenticity, which was like, yeah, I really just don't care about what you're talking about that much. Right.
Yeah.
Then there's this question of, well, how important is this relationship? Is it something that I want to sacrifice? Because I'm going to say, no, you need to care as much as I do right now. Not that that was a line that I ever used, but I mean, I think that's common interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
What can be perceived by others as an overbearing presentation. And yeah, I mean, I think that we immerse ourselves in this stuff because it's kind of hard not to once you get into it, and we lose sight. You know, good leaders or even good communicators, you know, good leaders don't get too far ahead of their followers. Good communicators don't stray too far from you know, the needs of their audience.
Yeah, and the feelings of their audience. Because oftentimes when we're talking to people, it's coming to them out of left field. You know, they don't really know the context here, and it's triggering maybe some anxiety and some fear, some worry about where the conversation is going and what, especially what its implications are for their connection needs, for their strategies by which they meet those needs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really speaks to a lot of different self-esteem dynamics for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a, you know, as in all the other chapters, he has a list of sentence completion exercises, and these really go back to childhood once again. If someone had told me my wants were important, if I had the courage to treat my wants as important, if I were willing to voice my thoughts and opinions more often, .. Yeah, I might encounter more disagreement than I normally do. I would have to stand up for myself. I would know more of who I am, you know? Others would know more of who I am. Those kinds of things. When I suppress my thoughts and opinions, I make myself smaller. I don't live the life that I want to live. You know, you just go through those things and subconsciously can provide endings to them. If I'm willing to ask for what I want, if I remain silent, or when I remain silent about what I want, if I am to express 5% more of myself today, or this week, or this month, or this year, it entails a lot of integration, obviously. And
yeah,
to live with self-assertiveness means to be more of ourselves, the self that we had as children, seeking out things and expressing ourselves creatively and with enthusiasm and enjoying our time spent with others as well. Like, this is all a process of social interaction. The self-assertiveness process doesn't have to come at the expense of great connections with others. I think that's one of the biggest lessons that we can learn from this practice, as Brandon articulates it.
There's a balance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're obviously, if you're practicing the pillars we've talked about so far, you obviously have a much better chance of living a life that's filled with harmonious interactions because you're putting out there for other people to observe and accept or run away from your true self. Mm-hmm. You know, so you're going to attract the people who best, you know, meet your real needs, your real feelings, your real desires, your real self.
Yeah. And there's another component to this that I don't think Brandon really delved into a whole lot, which is meta talk, which is speaking the unspokens. Because when we interact with people, like, well, the example that he gave, the guy that watched the movie, you know, what were the unspokens that were not spoken there? You know, what was the meta talk? What was the messages that were sent that each person's subconscious was picking up on that don't really get articulated? And I think self-assertiveness entails articulating those things more and more so that we feel comfortable with making our inner world vulnerable and transparent to other people. That's how we can develop more intimacy, more understanding, and ultimately more connection with others and connection with ourselves. Because if we leave parts of ourselves dormant, you know, not just to others, but to ourselves, you know, we've really sacrificed a great deal of what could be, what can be.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, speaking the unspokens, that's a really important thing in, you know, the psychotherapy world. Just making things explicit, talking about the messages that are being sent and, you know, really focusing on the importance of the meaning conveyed there, because people end up doing things unthinkingly, complying unthinkingly with things, not even raising a question about it. But if you really stop and really think about the messages that are being sent and making them explicit, like what we talked about at the beginning of the show, distrust, fear that people that are weak and need to be taken care of. These are the basic messages amidst all this political rhetoric about who's going to provide what to whom.
Yeah, when you said that, I mean, I was just thinking about how many of those decision points are driven by some form of fear.
Yeah. Yeah. So wouldn't that be an interesting political debate where one person would say, so what you're saying is that you're feeling fearful about these people being able to provide for themselves.
Oh my goodness. This might be a brilliant idea for a YouTube channel. Call it good thought reading.
Mm-hmm. Speaking the unspokens.
Yeah, absolutely. That's actually an interesting exercise for our listeners here to think about. You know, when we spend a lot of time on the Facebook and on the YouTube, maybe start trying to practice that a little bit.
And you're helping the other person really make those things explicit as well. Because like Rosenberg said, you know, he went to school for 12 years and no one ever asked him how he's feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But when you guess what the other person is feeling, so I sense that maybe you're feeling fearful. Is that right? About this issue or project or whatever it is, policy.
Yeah. What I'm suggesting too is that it might be kind of like a safe way, you know, when we're sitting at the computer, because it's always kind of a high risk operation, you know, to go to a real person you're disagreeing with and say, oh, no, you're just fearful.
Yeah, that would be sort of the presumptuous process, right? Yeah.
So hold my hand and I'll get you through this.
Where we're going is going to be much better. And if you start pulling away, I'm going to start tugging on your hand. You're going to follow me now, right? Come on, be with me.
Yeah, so that sounds like a recipe for breeding resentment.
Exactly.
So yeah, if you were just sitting at your computer, though, and you're scrolling through a news feed or you're watching some YouTube video, to ask ourselves, what's the meta talk here? I think would be an interesting exercise.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too, because it's really tapping into our subconscious knowledge. You know, Brandon notes that we have this sage self that knows all the things we think we don't know and can do all the things we think we can't do.
Yeah.
So the more we activate that process of really tapping into that self-wisdom, which is what the sentence stems are designed to do, you know, if I want to live more completely, there's a nice one. If I am willing to let people hear the music inside me.
Ah, that's nice. That is, I think, a great relief when you learn how to do that, or when you let yourself, or when I let myself do that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like this unwinding. Right. And the recognition that obviously you don't want to be, I didn't want to be like off-putting or offensive to most people and then just say, well, this is who I am. But I want to be who I am and attract the people who enjoy that. We're all different. You know, I mean, the things that make us who we are so numerous that it would be, compared to everybody out there that I'm going to interact with, a relatively small group that would say, yeah, that really jives with me, you know, mm-hmm. and that's fine. And it goes back to what I was saying about that inkling of discomfort that came back when I started doing the show. There was like this voice saying, well, you know, make sure you please everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Like that can actually be accomplished.
And over time, it happened very quickly, right? I think it was just the nerves of doing something new. That faded away. It didn't matter anymore.
Uh-huh.
You know? It's like what, you know, Jeremy always talks about, the value of having a niche.
Yeah, niche. There you go. Yeah, people that can see what you see and want what you want, for sure. And I was reminded of that meme, you know, you've got a list of things like dance, like nobody's watching, and there's other things that you do to express yourself in a way that doesn't have that self-consciousness. I think people admire that when someone expresses themselves in a way that's not self-conscious, you know? There's a degree of admiration for that. But there's also, when it really cuts against the grain of the culture, there's this fear of being attacked or disapproved of harshly when we express more of our self-esteem, you know? Because you imagine, like, in a communist country where self-esteem is pretty impoverished, obviously, to really express individualistic things can be, you know, life-threatening, actually.
Yeah.
You know, so I was thinking of that movie, Phenomenon, with John Travolta. Did you ever see that?
He gets struck by lightning or something.
Yeah, and he develops like these really amazing creative capacities, and his intelligence is amped, and it's almost like he acquires self-esteem, you know, a really strong conviction about his capabilities, and he's really fascinated about things, and his sense of life kind of really amplifies, you know. But you can see other people in the community just not knowing what to do about this phenomenon in him. And they're almost, you know, really fearful and almost hate who he's become, because it shows, it holds a mirror up to them and their own sort of lack of self-assertiveness in that process.
Mm.
That's what I noticed. Yeah. Even though the one theme, I guess, is, you know, a parapsychological phenomenon he supposedly possesses. Like, he looks at a mirror and breaks it.
Yeah.
In the bar, wasn't that a scene? You know, he has these different abilities that he doesn't know where they came from, but if you just look at it from a self-esteem point of view, it just seems like it really did a good job in the movie of showing how people can be really reticent and fearful about acquiring self-esteem and even attack another person who possesses it.
Phenomenon. All right. I'm going to start doing some YouTubes for that, YouTube searches. But, you know, a more coarse way that I've described that same thing, you know, the community reaction. And it's been applied to a lot of the interactions here in the city of Keene, New Hampshire. People get really upset about the recognition of this cage when they see people walking around outside of it, you know?
Yeah, people that aren't obeying those rules. Those rules are there for a reason.
Yeah.
Supposedly.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and then there's all kinds of labels that are applied to that behavior, right? You're not being responsible. You're being selfish, you know, and then just sort of harsher, derogatory words, of course, but
as if any of that has anything to do with the validity of the so-called rules.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's kind of a sideshow, isn't it? People are not addressing the fundamental issue, which is, can you have strategies that don't accord with the laws, but yet are really respectful of individual needs, of rights, of property rights? And of course you can. That's what libertarianism is all about. Being free to express yourself as an individual amidst a community of individuals. And it's all win-win. It's voluntary exchange. That's the bottom line, you know?
Absolutely.
Mutual consent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, in a sense, the libertarian community is asking, or voluntarist community is asking, the general community to live with more self-assertiveness, to be more of yourself as an individual, and not fear that you're going to just constantly run into conflict with people. Like, compliance leads to probably more conflict than perhaps even the most aggressive self-assertiveness. Sometimes.
Over time.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, it just if you look at the like the political trends in society, the authorities check in with people and mm-hmm. they say, not, you know, explicitly, but they put their finger to the pulse, right? And they say, hey, do you mind if we dress some people up in blue shirts and kind of like, you know, harass and molest you at the airport? Oh, you don't mind. Great, because we're moving them to the train station now.
So the compliance begets the aggressive self-assertiveness, doesn't it? The irrational assertiveness.
Right, until it reaches a breaking point. Right? So to say that compliance produces more chaos later is obviously very insightful. Because sooner or later, it becomes a control so out in the open, so explicit, it has to have a finite life. So if it continue, or maybe that's not true. Maybe if it's done slowly enough, people just kind of accept it.
I know.
The boiled frog thing, you know?
Yeah, they pulled it off for decades. Look at like the Soviet Union. For decades, it was a race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And they still haven't really pulled themselves out of the mindset in many ways. And oftentimes throughout history, it's a recapitulation of that. You get one regime, one empire that flourishes and then crumbles, and then you get another one. It's just this recapitulation of that theme of compliance and aggressive assertiveness, rebellion, you know, the revolutionary mindset.
Absolutely. So that being said, I have a nice way to end today, I think.
Excellent.
Three words. They're all derived from the same Latin root, auctor, which means master, leader, or author. And the three words that I'm thinking of, one is author, you know, the creator of a story.
Yeah.
The other is authenticity. And the other is authority.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the question is, you know, who is the author of our story? All the things that fit that word authority, you know, be it political, cultural, parental, school, none of those creating opportunities for us to be the author.
Yeah, it takes away our authorship for sure.
Yes, certainly not in those societies we were just talking about. But if people don't have that opportunity, it's obviously almost impossible to develop that third word, authenticity, which is what this pillar is really about.
Mm-hmm. The self-expression of living your life as an independent entity and connecting with others in this process in a win-win fashion and saying yes when you want to say yes and no when you want to say no.
Mm-hmm.
That would be authentic self-assertiveness.